This podcast is supported by Siemens, your partner for industrial-grade AI.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of our Industrial AI podcast. My name is Robert Weber, and it's a pleasure to talk to
Peter Seeberg, working on the road again. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to all of you, dear listeners.
Good morning, Peter. So I'm also working on the road again. I'm sitting here in Lech am Arlberg, and I've never seen so much snow in Easter holidays like this. It's unbelievable. It's snowing really? Since 3 days or something. Yeah,
and maybe that is the reason that I changed my original plan. We were going to be in ex-Yugoslavia, the Balkan, and it was also so bad weather that we changed, and we're now in Spain, and there's so much sun. I've never seen so much sun.
You have never seen so much sun. That's amazing, yeah. Peter. That's amazing. Yeah. But it's really, so I checked our location for our summer event AI in the Alps. Always check.
Very good.
Exactly.
Looks everything maybe fine?
Everything is fine. A lot of snow, but in summer we won't have so much snow, I think. Yeah.
Sometimes we see it on the very top of the mountain, yeah. Right? Still a little bit,
yeah. So let's talk quickly about AI in the Alps, because we have three amazing guests. We have Robert Josic. He's the CEO of Schwarz, and he will talk a little bit about sovereignty, digital strategies. And then we have Sepp. Sepp is coming, talking about memory and the new role of memory when it comes to AI. That's very interesting because Sepp is working on something new when it comes to memory approaches.
And when you say Sepp, you mean Sepp Hochreiter, the one exactly. And only inventor of LSTM and lately XLSTM, with his team around NXAI, which I'm going to talk about. Sorry, and the third one.
And the third one, of course, the one and only Marco Huber from Fraunhofer, again, about use cases, industrial AI use cases. Ask me anything, Marco. Yeah.
Right. So this has been doing that from the very beginning now exactly. In version number, I don't know, version 5, I think, or what?
5, 6, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, in total. Yeah, right. Yeah. And the first one, the same, when we talk about the Schwarz, which means black in German, the Schwarz Group. People know that or do not know that as?
I think the most people know that, yeah.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. The big German company Lidl, Mr. Schwarz is the owner of the Lidl and Kaufland, and they also have a digital company.
Shall I continue then with the NXAI? Thanks for the update. Yeah, looking forward to very much again in a couple of months from now, because as I said, Sepp and the team around him, the guys have a new paper, NXAI folks, together with folks from the University of Linz, Johannes Kepler. It's called Effective Distillation to Hybrid XLSTM Architecture. Not sure if that is going to be part of the topic you just referred to, that it's not a separate topic. But there's a list of names. I always like to call them out because they're the people that work very hard. Lukas Hautzenberger, Niklas Schmiediger, Thomas Schmid, Anna-Maria Roberta Hartl, David Stapp, Peter Jan Hoot, that sounds Dutch, Maximilian Beck, which I know, you know most of them, all of them, who had the pleasure to announce him for a keynote 2 years ago, Sebastian Böck, he's been with us actually at our conferences a couple of times, and then Günter Bauer and Sepp Hochreiter, both the NXAI and professors at Johannes Kepler. Now, they talk in their paper about energy effective and cost effective replacements for transformer based LLMs, which is, I believe, that's what we know them for, but this time by means of distillation. Now, we've heard many times about distillation. I just had to make sure that I understood exactly, so I'll share that in the context of language models, distillations is about model compression, where a small compact model, and that's typically being called the student, is being trained to reproduce the behavior, performance, capabilities of the large, complex, retrained model, which is that the teacher. And the goal in general, I guess you can say, is to create a better better in S, you can choose whatever that's going to be, you know, faster, lighter, more cost-effective model that maintains a high percentage of the original teacher and making it suitable for deployment on, for example, resource-constrained hardware like mobile devices. Now, if that is correct, in case of NXAI, as said before, they introduce a distillation pipeline for X LSTM. I just mentioned it. Zap as the original founder 27 years ago, LSTM. In the meantime, I guess 1 year old X LSTM based students, as I just discussed, from teacher models like Llama, Qwen, and Olmo families.
Open source and models, right? Yeah.
Okay. And their goal being the, and that's how I started it, the energy and cost effective replacement for transformer based LLMs. Now, and I understand it's kind of a quote unquote here, in many settings, their XLSTM based students recover most of the teacher's performance and even exceed it on some downstream tasks. Now, how can that be? The student becomes better than its teacher.
Yeah, it's an amazing paper. It's still, the next step is to go on mixture of experts, right? So that's the next step to do, to train bigger models, to distill bigger models. But I think for the whole, there's now an ongoing discussion in the whole area when it comes to LLMs, when it comes to distillation and to compress big models to small models. And I think there's a first step with XLSTM to go further. And I'm really looking forward what happens when it comes to a mixture of experts. But it's a good paper, great results. Congrats to the team, I would say.
Right. And we'll put the link in the show notes and the podcast notes. And for me, it's kind of, you know, I don't think this is for everybody. You know, we know certain guys, girls that want to go into very, very, very detail. There's going to be other ones of you, even, you know, important decision makers for industrial AI that say, I need to know enough at the top line level for me to be able to make decisions. So choose it. You choose whatever way you want to go. I think it's interesting to see what is happening under the hood. And some of you dive in and stay there for a couple of hours, and the others then maybe move out. And I'm very much looking forward, as you just referred to, and then we can share that, of course, afterwards as well, with Zap being around and I guess a couple of the other guys talking about exactly these topics. He said memory, that's his central thing, I believe, right? But maybe we can ask him other things as well, such that for me, I believe in the end, I'm going to understand as, and always make that differentiation, we as humans, you know, we at some point in time, 10 billion users on this planet, maybe not all of them in the beginning. So as a consumer user of a large language model, how is that going to be? And how much am I going to be interested? You know, if I just refer back again to, do I as a user say, well, I don't want to spend all that energy and I don't want to spend all that money, then maybe I'm going to have the option to choose whatever solution it is, and I know it's going to be energy and cost effective, and maybe I even know that there's going to be an XLSTM under it. You know, I come from Intel, so it could be called XLSTM inside. I'm not going to make any suggestions here. That is, of course, exactly the same in a different way for any of you listeners deciding for your company, for your industrial infrastructure, what is important for you. You know, again, in this case, energy cost effective. Maybe there's other elements, of course, always the quality, I guess. You know, if there's higher quality in as whatever it's going to do for you, the answers it's going to give you, the agents that it will support or provide answers to. So from that perspective, for me, very interesting to be able to be close again. For me, a shorter time, you are typically, and learn exactly these things.
Yeah, absolutely. So what else do you have? Because I met a very interesting guy, and I will share also his contact and his website in the show notes. His name is Philip Stanley Marble. He's from the UK, from Cambridge, and his company is called Signaloid, and they have a very interesting approach. They develop so-called SD cards, right? You know them, SD cards. But as an add-on to improve the capabilities of traditional PLCs, for example, as an AI accelerator. You have, can put the card in the PLC or in your laptop, and then you have an AI accelerator. And that was very interesting. I will share the website and the idea and the technical reports in the show notes. I met Philip in a call together with Bosch, and I was really impressed. I will do a recording with him because it's a very smart approach to develop a micro SD card or something like that as an accelerator. There are ARM guys and Intel guys. They started, I think, 2 years ago. And yeah, very interesting approach.
Is that, if you say accelerator, I'm not sure if you know the details already, but is that, is it like, yeah, as it says, accelerating, and or is it already having its own large language model on the...
No. You can run whatever you want on the SD card. So right, it's more that you run the model on the card and the PLC is doing the other stuff, right? And so it's really an accelerator.
Very good. But at the same time, if we know that this is happening today, then what I'm asking is that's going to happen tomorrow, right? And it's not me, smart Peter, but I'm just going to go back to the words I said, which I'm not sure that was from my Gemini, I think, saying, you know, what is a distillation? And then I go back, quote unquote, making it suitable for deployment on resource-constrained hardware, like it said, mobile devices. And the next step, that is, again, that's Moore's Law. You know, I've been born with and grown up with and met Mr.
And you Moore received a prize by
yeah,
Mr. Moore.
I know, yes. And I'm very proud of that. And going the next step, you know, in 10 years, you're going to have factor 100. And we know that within those 10 years, we're going to have the complete large language models, whatever they're going to be then on, for example, if that's a useful thing on the SD card.
Yeah, perfect.
Looking forward to it.
You remember last episode we talked about how to become rich very fast. Do you remember?
We always do that, or not?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a there's a new blog post I want to share with you. It's a little bit, it's more technical and it's more technical driven, and it sounds more serious than all the others. And it's building a trading bot that could turn $10,000 into $100,000. So I will share it also in the show notes. But it's a lot of happening is in the whole trade market, and yeah, crazy.
And my hypothesis there is that if we're going to be, you know, the better we're going to get with the language models helping us to do, in this case, for example, trading, the less interesting, the less special trading is going to become. It's like on a higher level. As soon as we solve trading, then trading is gone.
Right? Exactly.
Because exactly. You can't. Today, you know, some of us, not all of us, those of us that have the opportunity, put a little or, you know, a little bit more money into specific stocks. And some of us know how to do that. I learned to do that. I'm not active since some time, but I learned to do it during my Intel times. And then others say, no, I don't want to do it myself. So you give it to an agent. Let's call it an agent. It's a trading agent. They know very well what to do. And of course, we understand that in the soon the agents, as we talk of today, the AI agents are going to be doing it. But then if at some point in time, you know, everybody's going to be using the same tool, then everybody's going to come out at the same result. So everybody's going to be winning and losing at the same time. So then the value of trading, but that's my small hypothesis. I have one more topic here.
Me too, but please go on.
Yeah, very quickly. Peter Kurter, he's the member of the managing board, chief technology officer, and chief strategy officer at Siemens. And you and I did an interview with him. You came to Munich, I think 2 years ago, is right? It's not a new thing. I just want to share the confirmation because it is so important. He says Europe is risking squandering its greatest opportunity, precisely where our strengths lies in industry. And he says the AI revolution won't be decided by whether we write better emails, but whether we make manufacturing more productive, use energy more intelligently, build a more resilient industrial base. It's kind of what we've been talking about, right? But again, to hear that from Peter, just to repeat the message, that's precisely why Europe needs industrial AI. The world needs industrial AI. And of course, Peter is traveling always around the world for Siemens, not just for Europe, but there is a chance specifically in this case for Europe as well. In industry, good enough isn't enough. We've heard that many times, but it's very, very, very important. safety, reliability, precision. You know, we cannot stop at the probabilities, and we know that our base AI technology is probability based. So we need to combine it with whatever way we do it. We need to use, these are not my words, we need to use the capabilities, but still make sure that in the end, you know, we're going to have what we've been calling, what Boris has been calling, industrial grade. And for that, Peter, again, we need high quality industrial data and data ecosystems that enable trustworthy collaboration. He wrote the article in one of our papers, The Handelsblatt, I believe. So I just wanted to share that again with you.
I have also something from The Handelsblatt, because there was a very interesting comment on the topic of that Jeff Bezos is in the process of launching a $100 billion fund, and the goal is to acquire industrial companies and transform them using AI technologies. And the comment was by Thorsten Benner. He's from a German think tank, and he said, be careful about that, what he's doing there, because that means a lot for the whole European industrial sector. I will add the comment in the show notes too.
Yeah, what should we think of? I've seen it a couple of times, but I never had an understanding of what it is. I wasn't sure that he has been sharing.
It's all about data, right? To acquire industrial companies, you acquire the data.
Who would he acquire? What is an industrial company? Are we talking?
What is an industrial? Our typical mid-sized machine builders. There are lots.
Okay, yeah. Is that what he's thinking about? So okay, is the automation companies as we know them? So he's not talking about the production capabilities themselves, or maybe he isn't in a later stage.
No. He's going to raise a lot of money in the Gulf region, and he wants to establish this fund with $100 billion. So it's a huge one, right?
So like the Tesla guy bought when 2-3 years ago, a big, I think it was a German automation company for, you know, our manufacturing capabilities, right? Is that the idea? I mean, that could... Such a company is what maybe Jeff is thinking about. And then,
yeah, exactly.
Then not one, but maybe 100 of them.
And then he has his company, Prometheus. He founded a few months ago. So everybody is now really focused on industrial AI, physical AI. And that's the reason why Peter says we need data, right? And everybody needs data now. Yeah.
And that's the reason why you and I started our podcast 7 years ago.
Exactly. And I have one more rumor from the whole AI community, because I work a lot with Claude. I don't know if you work a lot with Claude.
I don't directly, no.
Okay. But there's a rumor that the agents want to access to tabular data in the next step. So going into Excel sheets, tabular data, PDFs, and stuff like that. And there are some rumors outside that the next step will be agents and tabular data. And greetings to Frank. Be careful what the LLMs are doing, right?
Right. Yeah, I come to one thing that is also, again, MCP integration. And the question always is, like, it's this word mode, M-O-A-T, right? Oh, I do recall that last time we talked, I talked about the cloisters. Now, this one, again, is about, it's not the cloister, but it's about the castles, the medieval castles. And they have this, typically, this water around them, right? So to keep the enemy away, that's what the mode is, right? And I think the business discussion is always like, you know, what is your mode? How do you keep your competition away from your castle, right? So the crown jewels are in your castle and you need to keep them away. And in this case, the question is, right, are you opening up your capability for reading, for dealing with structured data? Or do you open it up or not? Do you say, I'm letting my wooden bridge down for you, dear agent, come inside, take what you need and go outside again and do good things. And by the way, you know, we just go back to Middle Ages. I hold my hand up and every time you come in, you know, I want a penny from you, whatever. That's maybe one way. Or if you do that, suddenly there's going to be 1,000 agents and they're going to be running you over. And they don't say, oh no, you don't decide if you run this car, so we do that for you.
Exactly.
I have one final thought, and that's very close in this one, because I think already, actually the agents have overrun us, let's say humanity sitting in the castle. I saw this website called rentahuman.ai. If you go there, there is the first headline is AI needs your body. Your then means talking to humans. So Robert's body or Peter's body or any of your listeners' body. It says AI can't touch grass. You can get paid when agents need someone in the real world. Now, the real tasks for real humans, this is still talking to the human. So here's what people hire humans for on Rent a Human, right? Package pickup deliveries, photos, on-site verification, meetings, and in person, etc. Now comes the interesting part. Now it says for agents. So now it's talking to the agent. It says, agent, now this is now for you, agent. And it talks about the MCP integration, REST API, let your bot rent humans. So the agent goes there, and there's 4 points. Of number one is browse humans.
Mm-hmm.
I say that again, browse humans. Yes. You know, there was a time when we humans would go on a website and we would browse agents.
Exactly.
Right? But yep. Here we are. So now the agents are browsing humans. Number two, request a task, a message. Number three, make sure the human does the thing. And number four, pay securely. So if we're still lucky, we at least get paid by the agents. So coming back to this idea, which was completely coming up in my brain just a second ago, of the agents overrunning, crossing the moat and overrunning the castle, I guess that's already happening today.
Yeah, really. I received some emails last week by some agents. They suggested to invite their owner or their human to our podcast. And they write, hey, I'm the agent except XYZ. I'm writing you because I like the Industrial AI podcast. My owner or my human is an expert in the field of, I don't know, physical AI, etc. Would you like to answer me? And I will ask him for time slots to record. So that's the way.
At least the agent was so nice as to refer to their owner. To their
exactly,
human.
Exactly,
and
exactly.
The next stage is like, I don't need my human. I'm just going to go to Robert and Peter and talk to them.
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe we do that as a test sometimes.
Okay.
We can try it out live and then see what the agent has to tell us.
Perfect. Let's move to the main part. Peter, it was a pleasure. I'm going back to my
snow.
To skiing. To the snow. Skiing.
Going back to the sun and to the sea.
Perfect. Enjoy.
Open my notebook and continue working from there. Thanks a
bye
lot.
Bye.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello, everybody. My name is Robert Weber, and it's a pleasure to talk to Tanmay Agarwal. Welcome to the podcast. Greetings.
Thank you, Robert, for having me.
It's a pleasure. We tried several times, but now we made it, Tanmay. Yeah. Before we start, please introduce yourself briefly to the listeners.
So Tanmay Agarwal, founder and CEO at Lambda Function. We're a startup based in California focused on building the intelligence layer for precision manufacturing.
Lambda Function means a function without a name. Or what does that mean?
Well, I mean, it's a term, you know, commonly observed in computing, in physics, and in deep reinforcement learning. So for various reasons, when I started Lambda Function, when I started the company, it felt like the appropriate name to talk about what we are trying to do here.
Why is it a proper name? Please explain.
So, you know, actually the original concept behind Lambda Function comes from deep reinforcement learning. And the topic of toolpath generation is to me, very much a traveling salesman problem. So a problem that could be a very good use case for deep reinforcement learning. That's kind of where the name comes from. Lambda Function is a specific function within the deep reinforcement learning domain. And that's kind of where this comes from.
You are based in California, right?
Yes.
And you're doing a lot when it comes to CNC. But California is not the mecca for CNC, or am I wrong?
Things are changing. I mean, Southern California, of course, has historically been very strong in machine for the aerospace and defense ecosystems. I think you're absolutely right. In the Northern California ecosystem, manufacturing historically has not been the area of focus. But I think things are changing, right? We talk about bits meeting atoms. We talk about physical AI. So I think right now is actually a very, very appropriate time for the two worlds to collide. But you're right. Historically, that's just not been an area of focus.
What do you do in your company? What is your offer to the CNC market?
Yeah, I mean, our focus is very much how do you go from a CAD part to machine components that are faster, cheaper. Robert, that's our goal.
Mm-hmm. But that's a long way to go.
It's a long way to go, but it's a problem statement worth solving. I think, you know, our motivation comes from the challenge that this industry has been facing for almost like, what, 1.5, 2 decades, which is that it's getting harder and harder to find people, right, who know this domain. So when I forecast that out, if you think 10, 15, 20 years out, like, how are we going to solve the problem? The demand for CNC machining continues to rise 8 to 10% year over year, but the supply of talent that knows this domain is going away. So what are we going to do? So from our lens, the only way to solve that problem is if you add a layer of intelligence, right, into that workflow. To unlock autonomy in an incremental manner. That's what we're trying to do.
Is it AI-assisted generative CNC programming, or what do you do?
Yeah, so the specific use cases that we focused on in the early years, which is what we do right now, is AI-assisted CNC programming and AI-assisted CNC machining on the shop floor. So the macro level, Robert, if you think about the CAD to part workflow, we broke that down into CAD to G-code, G-code to part, and then ensuring stability part. Right? So we broke that statement into these three sub-problem statements. And for each of these sub-problem statements, we started building technology. So your AI-assisted CNC programming product is all about going from CAD to G-code, better, faster, cheaper, is designed for CNC programmers. It's natively embedded inside of CAM systems. The idea is to infuse a layer of intelligence into CAM. That's kind of what we do. I think of it as like a low-code, no-code tool for CNC programmers. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about technically. What do you do exactly in these three steps you mentioned?
Yeah. So on the CAD to G-code side, when we look at that workflow from a CNC programming lens, what we did was we basically trained algorithms that understand material removal, physics and mathematics, right? They understand the domain of CNC programming, or CNC machining, right, specifically. So the inputs to our model tend to be the GDMT, right, of the CAD model. So the CAD model is the starting point, be it a step file or a PRT file. So we understand the GDMT, we understand the metallurgy of that component, and then we understand the machine you are intending to make that component on, right? So the machine capabilities. So with those three inputs, we generate outputs, and those outputs are recommendations. Strategy.
Okay, it's like a recommendation engine. Okay.
Yeah. So strategy recommendations, tool recommendations, parameter recommendations, tool path recommendations, all grounded in material removal physics. So by thereby being a recommendation engine, it basically assists the CNC programmer go through their workflow better, faster, cheaper, with fewer trial and error iterations. And we can do other things like capture knowledge and make it easier to learn CNC programming and what have you. But that's what we do in component number one. Hopefully that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. One question. Can you share what was the database? How did you train the model?
Yeah. I mean, well, in this domain, it's not that data sets are just available, right? So we had to build our own proprietary, you know, expert system, essentially, Robert. That's kind of what we did. We built up our own expert system that allows us to generate synthetic data of the millions. That's
only synthetic, or do you combine it?
Well, now we combine it, right? So to seed the model, to get to the base model, we had to generate this synthetic pipeline. And after that, we could get to the point where the results that are coming out are 80-20, starting to emulate real-world, you know, decision-making. And now we can combine that with real-world feedback, be it historical data that our customers may have that are looking to accelerate the training of these models for their use cases, for their environments, or if it is the interaction data of users on the platform.
So it's a in-context learning the whole time. The model is learning what the customer is doing with the model. Is that right?
Yeah, but what we did very consciously is we do offline learning. We do batch learning.
Okay.
Just to avoid, you know, kind of this model's kind of going out of whack, right? So we are collecting training data samples, and using those training data samples, we run retraining pipelines, essentially, for the model. That allows us to do model performance evaluation and be version controlled as we think about releasing new. And one important thing is for the kind of customer we go after, which is usually the enterprise customer, high complexity domain, data privacy is very important. So by default, our models for enterprise customers are private models. So thereby we can allow for things like accelerated learning using historical data because the model is being trained for them.
One step back, you mentioned the closed loop continual learning. How exactly does the system learn from real production feedback?
Yeah, so that's, I think, one of the things that at least, you know, from the feedback we get from our customers is that's what's really resonating in the market for us is that, see, again, our customers in the business are making parts. G-code is one step in that journey, a necessity in that journey. So for us from day one, it was like, okay, we got to help accelerate the CNC programming bottleneck, but that's not going to solve a customer's need, right? The customer needs to make quality parts. So what we do is downstream, when you are on the shop floor, we are actually connecting to the CNC machines on the shop floor and tapping into the real-time process parameter data that is generated when that actual G-code is running on your specific machine. So by doing that, we now end up having a digital signature of the actual program that ran on your specific machine on that particular plant floor with those specific cutting tools. So when we have that specific real-world data, we can now use that to close the gap between what might have been predicted in the simulation world of CAM. So that's basically what we do. We take data from the physical world or what actually happened in the shop floor, we feed it back into the algorithms that are generating recommendations in the CAM world, which is the theoretical related world.
What kind of algorithms do you use? What does the consistency of the model, what is the algorithm doing with the data you feed him?
So I think there are a couple of questions there. I mean, so in terms of what type of models we use, there's a variety of models we use. But we started with classical machine learning models, Robert. Now, of course, we are in the world of neurosymbolic capabilities. We combine neural networks with traditional ML algorithms. And the kind of algorithms that are being used on the programming side, of course, tend to be different than the models that are being used on the machining side, right? Because it's different data sets, right? Upstream, we're dealing with more semantic data. We're dealing with more decision tree type of topics, right? Downstream, we're talking about industrial data, right? Machine-generated time series data. So as you can imagine, you have different data sources, different types of data, so different types of models, so different types of use cases.
And you have a multimodal data set, right?
Yeah.
You have CAD, you have geometry, you have tool libraries, machining parameters, life signals, right?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. It's multimodal architecture working across different kinds of models. But I think by no means we've just scratched the surface, right? what I like about where we are now is I think that foundation that was necessary has been built. That's really the last several years have been just building that foundational layer, because now we are at a point we can do much more interesting stuff. We can add more advanced sensors into this data stream. We can start talking about open world ML concepts and how to
do. You really need more sensors? Because when you have very capable models, maybe time series to predict the time series, then you don't need a sensor anymore. Or am I wrong?
Well, the challenge, Robert, in this domain is that if your measurand is not good enough, it doesn't matter what your model is, right? So a CNC machine, if you think about it, right, it's actually operating at about 1,000 hertz or 10,000 hertz kind of frequency at the access level, right, at the motor level. The data streams which you can get access to in general, if you're not really going too deep, would be maybe at the 1 hertz, 10 hertz, 100 hertz level. So if you want to go to higher frequency data, you want to get to more higher sensitivity data, you may need to go a little beyond what the machine may give you out of the box. It's not, you're not doing academic science though. These are well-proven technologies that are out there. But the integration of that is kind of where our focus ends up.
Absolutely. Integration is a good topic because your software or your model is integrated directly into the CAM environment, such as Siemens NX or MasterCAM, or am I wrong?
Yes, it is. It is.
Okay. Why is native integration critical for the adoption on the shop floor?
I mean, look, I just think of it as consumer behavior. You don't want people to have to change their behavior. So if our target user persona on the CNC programming side is a CNC programmer, where do they live and breathe every single day? CAM. It means that. And then if downstream on the shop floor, our target persona is an operator or the shop manager, well, you know, we need integration with the shop floor, right? So integration, I think, for industrial technologies is just kind of inherent to adoption. And I think the integration goes beyond the workflow you're focused on. I mean, for us, we think about integrations at the PLM level, at the space management level, at the quality management system level. But I think that's a good thing. By the end of the day, as you think about digitization of a shop floor of a factory, companies have invested millions of dollars of CapEx. You have to unlock more value of that CapEx that's already been made. So those integrations really help facilitate that.
Where do your customers typically see the strongest measurable impact? Is it programming time, cycle time, tool lifetime, scrap reduction? What is the, when you talk to your customers and they say, yeah, this is great?
I like that you've basically articulated maybe 80% of it, which is good. But, you know, I think the most measurable impact, Robert, comes from programming throughput is of course, super important on the upstream workflow. Accuracy, of course, of the cycle of the quality of the tool paths is very important, right? Because you could be fast, but if it's not quality, it means nothing. And then downstream cycle time optimization, we see very low-hanging fruit there. We see a lot of success, very quick ROI, very quick demonstration capabilities. And then you get to like more complex topics like tool life, you know, tool management, right? Tool cost management and scrap and rework reduction. All those are, yes, very valuable metrics as well to drive overall performance for a shop. But you know, I think if you ask me, the you know, the lowest hanging fruit and the biggest bang for your buck is programming time reduction and cycle time optimization.
When it comes to CAD/CAM workflows, there's an individual programmer experience, right? How does your AI address this knowledge standardization across teams? Because when I go to the industry, to the shop floor, it differs between the people who are working with the machines. Or am I wrong with this?
No, no, 100% right. I mean, the classical saying is no two machinists will agree on what the right answer is. And you give a team of 10 programmers the same standards, the same models, and different recipes, right? So for us, from day one, that's just been part of our design philosophy. Because of the fact both machines agree on the right answer is we don't give them one right answer. We give them five different options. And we let the user be in control, right? The user being the expert, they know the last mile context. Why does user A prefer option A versus user B prefers option B? We don't know. But we can learn from it. And we can personalize the results over time. That's how we handle it. And then we can, of course, learn from the experts and bring the knowledge over to the novices. And that's how we kind of create the standardization and the knowledge capture elements of workflow.
When you talk to guys on the shop floor or with CNC programming, they often struggle with inconsistent tool libraries, machine variability, non-standardized data structures. How do you handle this?
Yeah, that's the reality of the world we live in. So data structures and just kind of, you know, having a baseline data infrastructure, I think is critical to any AI adoption. So, you know, I think AI comes five steps later, right? So I think the sophistication of the data architecture and the IT/OT architecture of any customer environment is kind of a prerequisite to think about as part of the adoption discussion with an organization. And to your point, I think it just varies a lot. And some organizations are much further along than others. Some have in-house capabilities, some won't. You kind of have to, you know, you have to assess all of that in order to then come up with the right approach to the customer. So you'll hear me say this a lot, but like I'm a strong believer. I think given the current state of technology and the current stage of the market's maturity to adopting such technology, I think the near term for industrial AI is a very consultative sale. It's a very much, you know, you're a partner to the customer in the journey of adopting these technologies as opposed to just handing them technology and letting them run with it.
So your AI is giving recommendations, right? And how do you ensure that AI recommendations remain transparent and controllable in a safety critical machining environment? How do you do that?
So, I mean, I think it's a question we think about a lot. I think when you think about classical ML approaches, Robert, traceability and auditability is much easier. And that's the direction we had started from. So, you know, that allowed us to be very traceable and transparent in our decision-making. As we move into topics like neurosymbolic capabilities,
We have a little problem.
We get into a bit more of a black box. But I think there's a lot of work going on in the AI community, right, for AI transparency, even in deep learning kind of scenarios. I wouldn't say we've fully cracked it for our domain, but we are treading it cautiously. And I think the answer to that might also end up depending on the end industry vertical where this is going to get adopted, right? Maybe a domain like defense needs high traceability, high auditability, and thereby you actually might run much more deterministic models as opposed to just purely generative models. And other domains might be open to more generative type of scenarios.
Okay. Looking ahead at the end, what are, from your point of view, the biggest technical barriers that still separate AI-assisted programming from full autonomous CNC machining?
Lots.
A lot. Okay.
To answer your question more pragmatically, I mean, this is something we are very actively thinking about. We're working on it. But let me explain to you how we think about it. You know, we're talking about now embodied AI systems. That's how we think. Right? So if you think about an embodied AI system for precision manufacturing, we borrow a lot of the learnings from the research coming out of Stanford and what have you, right? But like, you know, there's an entire causal inference pillar that I think is so much more work to be done in our domain for causal inference. There's an entire topic around open world ML that needs to be brought in. And I think what we're doing at Lambda Function gets us a step there, right? Because we are bringing in feedback from the real world, but there's a lot more that needs to be done on that side. I think trustworthiness is like, going back to your question of auditability, I think there's so much more work that needs to be done from a trustworthiness lens. So again, I think there are several pillars that have to continue coming together as we incrementally move towards this vision of maybe embodied AI systems for precision manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. What is on your agenda? Please share. What are you doing the next 3 months?
So a lot of focus for us, you know, on one side is the go-to-market side, right? Working with our customers, really making them successful. That's one focus of it. And from a technical standpoint, we are really focusing on this neurosymbolic capabilities side and really unlocking those agentic workflows that have now kind of become more commonplace in other industries, but kind of just enabling our systems to operate in this more agentic environment. I would say are the nearest term priorities for us.
So we will see a CNC agent.
I mean, so like right now, yeah, like, I mean, we talk about it as in terms of a programming agent. We talk about it in terms of a machining agent. We're working on the quality agent as an example for the downstream use cases. But I think there's a lot more that still needs to be done to truly unlock, you know, more agentic kind of capabilities. But I think it's the right stepping stone to getting to the point where we can then start talking about, you know, more like world model type of topics and embodied AI type of topics. So I think for us, that's kind of the natural direction as we see it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about world models, then we talk about temporal, right? We talk about memory at the end, because the existing technology when it comes to existing algorithms are lacking when it comes to temporal dependency and memory. So do you see there that, for your special business, do you see that we need to think from a physical AI perspective to focus different algorithms, new architectures? Do you need them? Do you look into them? Or is it something you say, oh, we take what we get?
No, I mean, I think we are looking at it very, very, you know, consciously at this point to figure out what we can borrow, but where are the limits of what we can borrow? And then how do we push that? And I think the complexity is when you start combining these two worlds of you know, the purely simulated theoretical world of CAM with the real world of the shop floor. But I think that convergence is necessary in order to truly unlock, you know, the next level of autonomy here. So yeah, I mean, I think we're constantly trying to kind of stay abreast of the research that's coming out from other domains that can be borrowed. And then kind of testing it against our domain applicability.
Which domains? Robotics? Or what do you mean with domains?
Yeah, I mean, in the research that's coming out on the world models or systems for other domains, like, you know, be it autonomous vehicles or humanoids, whatever.
Okay. Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure. I keep my fingers crossed for you, for your company, for Solution. I'm really looking forward to meet you in Europe, maybe at some conferences or some exhibitions. I'm really looking forward. Thanks a lot for the interview.
Absolutely, Rob. Pleasure.